as I wait. Heart
Hello,
of God.
And welcome to the Growth Group podcast, where we believe that spiritual growth happens better in circles than it does in rows. My name is David Haken, and I am joined by Jonathan Markham, the pastor of New Life Christian Fellowship here in Pacifica, California, and we record these podcasts to help you get the most out of your small group discussion each week. This week we are, I know we told you last week it was our last time in Ephesians, but no, this for real is the last time that we are going to be dealing with Ephesians under the series title, No Oars, Only Sails. Yes. It's been a really impactful series, getting us to think about us and our role as a church and how God has called us to serve this world and how He's empowered us and gifted us. And maybe talk a little bit about why you felt that this series needed just one more sermon.
Well, I've been using very, very vaguely or very roughly a book called Mobilized for More. Which has been created by a group called Exponential, and the more I've gone through this this series, I realized that the whole corporate nature of the call to the church is something which. It's an emphasis that I have not placed on this letter before.
Yeah. Okay.
And Ephesians. I've always read Ephesians as a call to all sorts of individual, all sorts of developments of my individual spiritual life. Which I'm not saying it isn't, but it's also a call to our corporate lives, and I think that God is saying to us as a church, as He's creating in us emotional health, He's not creating us in emotional health so that we'll just feel better. He's creating in us emotional health so that we can fulfill our part in His plan.
Yeah.
And do that together. And so I felt that I wanted to give an extra emphasis to the corporate nature of the call that I mean, I saw one person write that Ephesians was a constitution for the church, and constitutions are for a nation or a group of people, not for individuals.
Huh, just flipping through Ephesians right now as you were speaking, I see a couple passages definitely jump out as we're talking about the church as a community. I mean, in the very beginning of chapter 4, he encourages them to walk in a manner worthy, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. There's one body, one Spirit, one hope, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. So we're all united under these different claims.
And even right at the beginning, you suddenly realize that he's talking, he repeatedly uses plural pronouns.
Well, that's going to be true in every single letter of Paul.
Right.
Because he's writing to a church body.
But he is writing to a group of people.
Right. Except for Timothy, I guess, is the only exception.
Yeah.
And perhaps
he's writing to a group of people, and so there are group there is a group application that it's easier that it's easy to miss, I think, or certainly it's been easy for me to miss.
And you get that in the latter half of chapter 2 as well, where we're talking about this mammoth shift from the people of God being composed almost entirely of Jews, and if there weren't Jews, then they were proselytes brought into the Jewish community and faith through circumcision and all that other stuff. And now here it talks about the dividing wall being broken down and now the Gentiles have been brought in. So this is big shift in life. We're extending the boundaries of the people of God.
And it must have been such a radical statement for somebody who was such a Jew's Jew, in a sense, to say these things.
Totally. Well, we need to, you know, as we're doing this very last kind of wrap-up sermon on Ephesians, we're going to hit some of the big points that we've emphasized throughout this series. The first question addresses the title of the series, Oars and Sails, and this is how that question reads. Every week, this series in Ephesians has challenged us to put down our oars, following our own agenda in our strength, and put up our sails, pursuing God's agenda by His power. Have you gained a better sense of what this means and how to do so? How is it that those who are carried along by the wind of God's Spirit, that is, their sails are up, how is it that those who are carried along by the wind of God's Spirit, fully aware of their position as a masterpiece, will become emotionally and spiritually mature? So here we are, linking this series mm-hmm. with the previous series.
Yes, and you know, we've so much of what we said in the Emotionally Healthy series was the fact that many of us don't know ourselves, because yeah. we're living lives, or our lives are directed by what other people think of us, what we think is going to impress other people, all of those things, anything but even what makes us comfortable. And yet, what Paul's saying all the way through the Ephesians, right the way from the beginning, is we are called to live in accordance with what he wants us to do, to fill everything with himself. That we're called for a purpose.
Yeah, there's a sense in which a commission is deeply fulfilling. You know, it's like we all have this deep sense of a desire to know and be known, to connect with our Creator, but then also to have purpose, to have a goal and a driving motivation.
Give our life meaning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and so much, and so many of us have gone through periods of life when we struggle. What am I here for?
Why
what
get
is
up in
my
the morning?
Meaning? Yeah. And you know, and so we're saying, not only this is why you're here, but this is why you're part of this community.
Why you've been called from before the foundation of the earth.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is why you're called. This is why you're part of something that God planned for you. I mean, in a sense, somebody might have felt I was repetitive here, but to actually try and get into our heads the fact that God knew us before the beginning of time, and he knew us by name, and he had purposes, jobs that he has specifically designed for us to do. That is such a mind-blowing idea.
Right, yeah, the Ephesians 2:10 thing. But we have a question about that. Actually, no, that does come up here in this question, Ephesians 2:10. Yeah, we are God's workmanship, his masterpiece, called to do good works, which he prepared for us in advance to do. Well, he's prepared for you and I in advance to record our second question, so maybe we'll get on to it.
Yes.
Called Make Disciples. Have you memorized our church's new purpose statement? Ooh, pressure's on, y'all. That purpose statement reads, "We are sent and sending others to be disciples and make disciples everywhere we go." Take a minute to commit this to memory and recite it to your group. Discipleship can take countless forms. What are some real-life situations in which everyone in your church can participate in making disciples? In what way does this relate to our calling to fill everything everywhere with Christ?
Great question. It's you
just
know,
don't start it with "we are called to."
Yes, I've been thoroughly admonished for making it so difficult for you all to remember this statement. But
I think maybe if you were to start by saying "we are sent to," like just give them the first two words, then they can maybe fill the rest out easier.
Yes.
I don't know. Is that cheating?
Well,
we are.
I don't
sent
know, but I certainly
to,
won't. I certainly can't help you. I certainly am not going to help you if I start with something which is not
yeah.
grammatically correct. But you know, it's such an important.
My feeling is if you were to say "we are sent and," I think that's all they need. Then they can roll out
right.
with standing.
But hopefully, we're
going
to get to the point where they don't need that.
Sure.
They don't even know. They don't even know, need me to say the first words. But anyway, I mean, I hope that we've had a much broader sense of what it means to make disciples. That in a sense that that making disciples. I was reading recently what is a disciple, and that, you know, there's as many definitions as there are, you know, flavors of breakfast cereal, but one of the things was saying that disciples are more than followers of Jesus, mm-hmm. because a disciple not only follows somebody but wants to become like them. That the essence of rabbinic relationship with their disciples was that they followed them to learn from them and to become like them. Mm-hmm. And that's the essential nature of... But it starts with, in a sense, discipleship starts with recognizing who Jesus is. Because it's when we recognize who he is...
You can't become like someone you don't know.
Right. And you can, and you, and until you decide you want to be like him, then you're not going to try very
Desire's
hard.
Desire is important.
So part of our discipleship process is, and again, it refers to a question we're going to have in a minute about the different gifts that we have. Mm-hmm. That part of that we're all part of the discipleship process. There will be we will have different roles in people's lives. That you know you may be the person. I mean, you might. Do the whole gamut, but you may be the person who engages somebody in
right.
In,
I feel like you've referenced a couple times from the pulpit, like your role this week may be to smile at the person at the grocery store, and it's like, gosh, is that discipleship? But you're opening the door for warm communication relationship,
right.
Possibly.
And it may be maybe that was just what they needed right now. Mm-hmm. At that moment, and you
yeah.
don't know why
and
they meet.
You wouldn't classify that as discipleship, though. But it's doing the Lord's
right.
work in a way.
Yes,
yeah.
I would. I'm not sure that smiling.
We don't want to open the door that wide.
No, I don't want to open it that wide because that in a sense trivializes it a little bit. But smiling to somebody may be the key that unlocks a conversation.
Yeah.
That unlocks a conversation that says that enables you to not recite the four spiritual laws, but to actually just let somebody know that you're a Christian, and that I mean it's a bit like that lady that I met in Barnes & Noble when I prayed for that lady.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean I don't know who she was, but I prayed for her. Now maybe one day she'll think, well, somebody prayed for me. I wonder what that means.
Right, right. There's a Christian out there somewhere who cares for other people. I wonder
right.
if I should take this more seriously.
And I wonder, and maybe it made her feel better. Maybe. And maybe she'll think, well, maybe I should
the
ask
Lord
a Christian
prayer,
what that
yeah.
means. You know, somebody prayed for me. And what's all that prayer about? You never know how that... And that can be the first minuscule step of discipleship, of bringing a person to
right.
know Jesus... And to want to follow them.
Right, yeah. I planted, Apollos watered, but God
yeah.
gave the growth, kind of. Our third question is, we're going back to the army for this one. Back in the army. It's called Allied Forces. The Bible uses several metaphors to indicate that we, when we become Christians, we are incorporated into an army. Soldiers are known for their meticulous care for individual health, that is intensive training routines, strict cleaning regimen for their weaponry and personal bunk, but also for an unwavering commitment to the good of their squad. How has Ephesians confirmed this calling for Christian soldiers, too? Caring for themselves spiritually and joining forces with their brothers and sisters in Christ.
Yeah, I think that one of the ideas which really drove me to take this this last sermon mm-hmm. was I woke up with, for some reason, thinking about boot camp. And what happens in a boot camp?
Which say that there's three phases?
Yes. The first phase is that you are... the first phase is you're inspired by a recruiter.
Right.
You
get there in the first place
yeah.
somehow.
And somebody has...
decision.
Somebody, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're what your status in life is. What you're inspired by some recruiter who tells you, oh, you'll love this, and this is your, and then
right, you're serving your country.
And Paul inspires us in a sense with the first chapter.
Yeah, that's Ephesians 1.
Ephesians 1.
The first half. Yeah.
But then, when the moment you sign on the dotted line,
chapter 2,
you are reduced to you are humiliated.
Right.
In the boot camp, you are brought down to like you know
2:1.
Once you were dead.
And, yeah, you were dead in your trespasses.
Your hair's cut off. You're equalized.
Someone's screaming in your face, and your preacher, you have right. your saliva just
and
dotted.
It doesn't matter whether you were an attorney before you were, or you graduated. It doesn't matter. You are brought to a point where you're all equal.
They're so close, you can tell whether they use Crest or Colgate.
Yeah. And then they build you up together with a dependence upon one another and a commitment, as you just said, to the squad, to the people. You are...
It wasn't sort of squad is the right word, I think.
No, but whatever, the battalion, the...
Maybe that's right.
Whatever they... But the group of people, you are utterly committed to... They have to know that you've got their back and that you're... And that
their life literally
depends on it. And so we are, but God, what Paul says to the Ephesians is so much more hopeful and encouraging, because he doesn't say you're a filthy little squirt, but he says you're a masterpiece. But you're all masterpieces.
Right, and, right. At every one of those negative sections, it's always followed by a "but God" passage.
Yeah, and so he builds us up, and then he's going to equip us with all sorts. He's going to equip us with all sorts of gifts, which you would do as when you come out of your boot camp. You know, you become an engineer, you become a this, that, and the other.
Right, but that specialization.
But that whole corporate mentality has been inculcated into you in such a way that you know how utterly dependent all of the members of the army are on one another. And I think that's what we have to, that's what God wants us to feel as Christians, that we're in a battle, we are equipped, and we are utterly dependent upon each other. And if we don't play our part,
right, we're only as strong as the weakest member, in a certain sense,
in a certain context,
certainly. Well, our last question, our fourth question, deals with a bit of a question we addressed last week as far as the armor of God, whether it's offensive or defensive. Well, we'll see if you can pick up some of that conversation here in our last question. Love offensive, it's called. Not like being offensive. Anyways, we learned last week that our fight against the spiritual forces of evil was strictly defensive. But in our effort to make disciples, God calls us to a love offensive. How is love foundational to both discipleship and to our Christian life in general? How does Ephesians 2:10 encourage you in your effort to continually be a smelly and shiny Christian?
We can do
a love offensive.
Yes.
Now, that's your phrase, isn't it?
I think it, yes.
Well, why don't we
love
explain
is our
that?
Most offensive weapon. The thing we talked about was the fact that we are actively defensive against the forces of the evil one. We're not passively defensive. We don't just stand there and let him hit us. Or run away. Mm-hmm. We are actively defensive. But if there is one area, I think that there are two areas where you could classify this as offensive, and that is prayer, and then I think the most effective offensive weapon we have is love.
I think it depends on the context we're talking about.
Yes.
So, like, are we in the context of a conflict with the spiritual realm, or are we in the context of the making of disciples?
Right.
You know, like, and we're talking about different things here.
If we're in the spiritual realm, then love is not, we don't love evil spirits,
Second Peter tells us there's no second chance for them.
Right. And the word, and when Jesus faces Satan, he uses the word, and he repels him with the word.
Yeah.
But however, when the evil one comes at us through other people, then if we respond actively by loving them, that becomes such a potent weapon that to defuse something because by being loved.
Right.
And to and it does two things. It diffuses the enemy, but it also demonstrates the amazing nature of Christ, who loves us unconditionally. And it opens the door to say, why do I love you like this? Because Jesus loves me like this and loves you like this. And that,
right. That's right out of 1 John.
Right.
We love because he first loved us. Yeah. Yeah.
And so in that sense, it becomes an offensive weapon. It pushes into the enemy territory directly.
Now, this question has two parts. It talks about, becoming an imitation of Christ as well, being loving as he's loving. But that also talks about how love plays a part in discipleship. Maybe you want to address that for a minute?
Right. I think that when we begin to share the love of Christ with other people, that's when walking with Jesus becomes attractive. Mm-hmm. And when you're discipling somebody, not by telling them what a screw up they are, but by loving them enough to not leave them where they are. What Jesus says, the way Jesus says, I love you and I accept you as you are. Then so that
the woman
love
at the well.
Yes. That love draws somebody in. And then the love says that I'm not gonna leave you as you are becomes so much more potent when they know they've been accepted.
Right. What was your definition for agape love?
Relentlessly and unconditionally pursuing the absolute best for everyone else.
Now maybe we should memorize that one too. But as far as pursuing the best for another person is going to mean changing for the better. It's going to require them to become.
And that reflects exactly what Jesus did. Jesus, the woman at the well. Jesus didn't leave her where she was. Mm-hmm. The rich, the woman who was caught in adultery. He didn't leave her where she was. He just said, "Go and sin no more." That's pretty unequivocal. It's not sort of go away and try hard. It's go and sin no more.
Right. After calling her daughter.
Yeah.
Pretty profound.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we are going to call that a wrap for our series. We have not only put our oars down, but we've shredded them, turned them into sawdust, used them as furniture legs. They are no longer effective. We have no desire nor temptation to pick them up again. And we are just floating along with the breeze. We're going to be in Psalms next week.
We are.
Returning to that song. We're getting real. And we're there for 3 weeks, or is it four?
Three.
3 weeks. Do we know the third psalm yet? Or keep it a surprise?
I'll keep it a surprise.
Keep it a surprise. You guys have to stay tuned in for next week. Until then, God bless.
As I wait, heart of God.